staring out the view screen, sipping his brew.
Mind-boggling sometimes, how tiny we are, moving through something so vast.
And there were many people out there who couldn't handle it, couldn't live a life in space. If you weren't a seasoned traveler, the endless nothingness, the long stretches of isolation, could weigh on a person's mind, overtake it, put you on a path to madness. She'd seen it once on the Hakon, when they'd been set adrift, months on end, food running out, not a single star in sight. Cade had. No. Memory Lane wasn't a place she wanted to visit right now, so she focused on the cigarette poking out of Ram's shirt pocket. She hadn't seen him smoke since she'd found him on Kamoya.
You ever going to smoke that thing?
He shrugged.
Trying to quit. I'm down to smelling it every once in a while.
You know we have patches for that, right?
He returned her sarcastic smile, then shrugged.
Call me old school. So I was looking over the report from Gex Compad, he said, changing the subject. He sounds serious about whatever he thinks is in the debris field. He mentions using it against us, hitting us at our heart. I think he means Earth.
Ryan pulled her feet under her and then took a sip from her mug.
If he believes he can make it there and make a statement, he won't hesitate. He might make it to Earth, but he'd have to get through Homefleet.
Ram thought about it for a moment.
Unless he has help from the inside. The alien refugee settlements on Earth are growing. Makes you wonder how the hell they're able to weed out the bad from the good.
Good point. How? Even the refugees were at risk.
There's been talk for a while, Covenant loyalists wanting retribution against defectors, wanting to send a message. Those refugee settlements on Earth might be courting disaster. Once we get the salvage and find a port with a decent comm relay, I'll turn Gex's report over to the authorities.
His attention was drawn once more to the view.
Strange to think of jackals, grunts, and hingeheads making a home on Earth after they wanted us all dead. Well, we'll be lucky if we're not permanently barred from the planet if Oni ever finds out what we're planning.
Would that bother you? He scratched his beard, thinking.
I don't know. Never been to Earth.
He paused to take a drink, then shrugged.
Guess I'm like most. A small part of me always yearns to see the homeland.
She smiled over the rim of her mug.
Didn't peg you for the pilgrimage type?
He shot her an eye roll.
All of us colonists are, to some degree. I might be Kamoyan, born and bred.
He grinned as he recited familiar lines.
But in me lies the need to tread on shores of sand and plains of red, on soft green grass to lay my head, past stars and years to distant view, a long way home I push on through. She calls and sings her song of blue, my heart, my soul, my homeland true.
Ryan mentally recited along with Ram's spoken words. The lines were from a famous folk song written by early colonist Mary Parker Mead. Known throughout the colonies, it was the kind of simple song taught to schoolchildren and sung at events and holidays and by happy drunks in bars. It was an everyman anthem, and it was sung replacing the first line with whatever planet, colony, outpost, or ship you called home, just as Ram had done.
Earth is home as much as Kamoya is, he admitted. I think it's a need in all of us to see it at least once, don't you?
She might have felt a tiny twinge of homesickness, but Ryan's perspective, being born and raised on Earth, was far different from those growing up in the colonies. There was and would always be something special and even mystical about Earth. There would always be those wanting to go home, like Ram, and those wanting to leave, to branch out and make their own way, as Ryan had done.
Since we're up, she said, let's recon the system and see what else is out there.
They worked silently after that, noting the giant orange star coming into visual range as Ace adjusted course through the asteroid belt, and then toward the four small planets that orbited the star. An hour later, Gyrinos A was in their sights, and they'd located the Oni commsat. Ryan kept Ace out of range of the commsat and settled the ship into high orbit. Lessa entered the bridge with two breakfast wraps. Thank God for a crew member who liked to actually cook meals instead of relying solely on packaged fare, and handed one to Ryan and the other to Ram.
Figured you two would already be at it. So that's it, huh?
Looks inviting.
If you say so.
Besides the color,
Ryan thought it looked a lot like the old pictures of Mars before the planet had been terraformed. She took a bite of her wrap and groaned. "That's the last of the Brillen eggs, by the way," Les said. With her other hand, Ryan pulled up the planet's image on the tactical table. "Pretty barren. Mostly sand and rock. Atmosphere is too thin for much, if anything, to survive." "So we're not looking for survivors, then?"
"Depends," Ram said around a mouthful of food. "Whoever or whatever sent the distress call might have enough oxygen reserves to live on. Or, if there's a ship down there, could have a pressurized section still able to support life."
Lessa spun the holograph to find a blue dot indicating the location of the signal. "At least the light gravity will make carrying stuff a breeze. Once Nico is up, we'll send in Michelle to recon the comsat and see if we can disable it." "He's up," she replied, her tone suddenly rigid. "Heard him in the gym." Ryan regarded Lessa for a long moment. "He didn't mean it, you know," she said carefully. "What he said back in New Tyne?" Lessa shrugged.
"I know he didn't, but that's not really the point, is it?"
Ryan had the feeling it was a question she couldn't or shouldn't answer, so she left it alone. When nothing more was forthcoming from the girl, Ryan finished her food and then buzzed the gym as Ram left to get dressed.
"Yeah," came Nico's out-of-breath response.
"Need you to prep Michelle when you're done."
"Okay, give me 20 minutes.
True to his word, Nico arrived on the bridge just shy of 20 minutes later, freshly shaved and showered, a definite change from the last several days.
"Michelle's launched," he announced,
and headed for his comms console to pull her feed up on screen and direct her movements. The drone, affectionately dubbed Michelle, had begun her life as a UNSC spy drone, but under Nico's care, she was all that and more. The commsat wasn't easy to spot. The thing was encased in flat, black stealth coating and was only about 26 centimeters in circumference. Michelle approached and scanned the satellite.
"There's no SATCOM network out here, so it can't relay information, only store it," Nico said. "It's using a disruptor wave to break up the distress call. It's illegal for us to mess with commsats, especially military and government. We could leave it alone, destroy it, or bring it on board so I can salvage the components," he said, glancing over his shoulder. "My vote is for salvage."
"Well, we can't leave it and risk it recording our activities," Ryan said. "Can you disable it before bringing it on board?"
"Can you disable it?" he echoed,
shaking his head and returning to his screen.
"Yeah, of course I can disable it."
Nico commanded Michelle to send out an EMP pulse, rendering the commsat inert, then employed a magnetic well to tow the device back to the ship. Once Michelle was docked and the airlock engaged, Lessa went down to the cargo bay to receive the device and then deployed Michelle again for an exploratory flyby over the distress signal's origin. As Nico guided Michelle through the atmosphere of Gyrinos A, Lessa returned and fed him navigational corrections to account for the winds. Soon the surface appeared, a wash of sand and dunes, with a few rocky outcroppings dotting the landscape.
"Coming up on the signal," Nico said.
The drone descended over a pile of slate-like rocks and slowed to a hover above an antenna stuck into the ground. A thick band of cables ran down its length and over the sand.
"Well, clearly someone did this," Les said. "There must be survivors."
"Or were. We don't know how long this thing has been broadcasting," Ryan said.
"Guess we just follow the lines?" Nico asked,
glancing to Ryan for confirmation, before piloting Michelle along the cables. Down the dune and into a flat valley, half-buried bits of wreckage began to appear. Then a large section of fuselage came into camera view, with a jagged opening covered by a wind-worn cloth, flapping in Gyrinos A's steady winds.
"That looks like a shelter," Ram said, standing.
"And look, the cables lead inside," Lessa said.
"Wait, Nico, back up,"
Ryan sat up straight.
"Angle down. Those are tracks."
The sand was already filling in the impressions. "Someone was definitely down there, recently.
Ram, you got anything on life signs?"
"No, nothing."
"Could we be getting interference from the winds?"
"I'm not picking up any."
Ryan tapped her finger on the arm of her chair. Odd, but there was only one way to find out who'd made those tracks. She pushed up from her seat,
energized by the anticipation and excitement of discovery. Ram, since you're still recovering, you'll take over here. He frowned at her, returning to his seat.
I'm good, Forge. Body is chock full of nanites.
Yeah, and they're still repairing you, so you'll be our eyes on the ship. Les and Nico will come with me. Let's suit up, kids, she said with a clap. Grav carts, cutters, medkit, and we go in armed until we know what we're looking at. Ram, set us down here.
She leaned over the tactical table and pointed to a spot on the holographic image.
Just on the other side of those rocks, and keep Ace running and weapons warm until we know what kind of survivors we're dealing with.
Ram swiveled in his chair.
Don't forget that Oni thinks the site is dangerous enough to issue a proceed with caution. Remember that. Tread carefully.
She nodded.
Will do.
The Ace of Spades settled onto the sand, using a rocky dune as protection from the winds streaming at a steady 20 knots. Ryan, Nico, and Lessa were waiting at the cargo bay in light fatigues and breathing masks with oxygen converters and reserve tanks, with grav carts and tools at the ready. As soon as Ryan saw the green light on the pad by the door, she hit the airlock and released the ramp. Hot, dry air and sand swirled as they exited the ship with their gear. Ryan's boots should have sunk deep into the soft sand, but the gravity was so light that she barely made a dent.
"Comm check," she said, and waited for Nico and Les to reply.
"All good, Cap," Lessa said, glancing around. Nico was staring down at his feet before jumping a few times to test the gravity.
"Geez, aren't that light," Ryan remarked. "Come on, let's get moving."
They made their way across the sand to the rocky dune in the distance. Leaving their gear at the bottom, they climbed to the top to inspect the antenna.
"Well, at least we know there were survivors at some point. This didn't get here all by its lonesome," Lessa said, craning her head.
The antenna was more than 3 meters high and made from a long titanium shaft.
"Looks like some sort of ground plane mast radiator combo," Nico said. "Depends what's underneath it and what's attached at the other end of these cables."
"Should we turn it off?" Les asked.
"Yeah, shut it down," said Ryan.
Nico dropped to his knees and brushed the sand away from the ground to inspect the cables.
"Hold up. The cables have been stripped and wired directly into the shaft and this broadcasting board. Honestly, never seen anything like it. It'll be easier to shut down from its power source."
He glanced behind him at the trail of cables snaking down the dune.
"All right," said Ryan. "Let's get off this rock and find the source then."
Ryan went slowly along the cable's path, directing her grav cart beside her, and picking up a few pieces of ship wreckage to examine and then toss back into the sand as they went across the valley floor. They wouldn't know what kind of craft they were dealing with until they got to the main site. A sudden glint caught her eye. She picked up what appeared to be glass and realized it was vitrified sand. So far, what she was seeing wasn't exactly consistent with survivors. A wreck this bad, this old and weathered in this kind of environment, crashing hot enough to turn sand into glass. Although it wasn't unheard of, people surviving through insurmountable odds like this. Yet, even if there was a chamber buried somewhere under the sand with oxygen and pressure lasting for years, there still was the issue of food.
"Hey," Les's hand nudged Ryan's shoulder. "Look at that."
She pointed to a raised area, a couple meters away, stacked with a mound of rocks. A piece of metal jutted up from the stack to mark the spot.
"Is that what I think it is?"
"A gravesite."
Ryan stared at it for a long moment, feeling very keenly that something just wasn't right. Nothing was adding up the way it should. As they continued on, she asked,
"Ram, still not picking up any life signs?"
"No, nothing."
"Any traces of power?"
"No, it's really quiet. Nothing breathing or moving."
"Gotta love a good mystery," Nico commented dryly.
"All right, we're coming up on the main site."
Intact, the fuselage would have been enormous. Most of it now was either buried in the sand or sheared off. The cloth hanging over the jagged hole was ripped and threadbare, flapping in the wind with audible snaps.
"This is starting to feel really creepy," Lessa said, eyeing the entrance and the cables that disappeared inside.
Ryan pulled her rifle over her shoulder.
"Heading inside."
Carefully and slowly, she ducked past the cloth and entered the wreck.
The floor was sand, but the walls were clearly titanium plating. As Ryan moved farther in, it became dark enough that she had to use her light to see down the length of the hull. With Les and Nico doing the same, they revealed a strange scene of what appeared to be a collection of wreckage. Ryan moved toward a makeshift work table built out of storage containers, its top consisting of a long piece of metal plating and piled with cables and wiring, cracked screens, a few dead power cores, and an assortment of system components and motherboards. Lessa stared down at the table, where a collection of random personal effects had been placed, a belt, burned photos, a hairbrush, a sock, a broken bottle of brandy.
Yeah, definitely creepy.
Nico picked up a few system components and tossed them into his cart.
I really don't want to run into a dead body, Lessa said, her nerves getting to her. Especially one in a mask or a spacesuit. No offense to the dead or anything, but that totally freaks me out.
That happened to you one time, Nico replied.
Yeah, well, one time was all I needed for it to be awful. She shuddered. And you were the one who screamed and ran away first.
Yeah, sure. I think your recall needs work.
He found a serial number on a small piece of tech and ran it through their database.
No, it doesn't. You dropped your tools and left your grav cart and went running through the grass. You tumbled ass over end and then popped right back up and kept on going to the ship. I remember because it was funny as shit. And I had to make two trips to get your crap because you refused to go back out to the site.
Whatever.
Don't you ever take responsibility for anything? She asked,
nerves quickly replaced with annoyance as she reached beyond Nico for a piece of wreckage. He didn't move out of the way because a name popped up on the scanner, so she gave him a quick, forceful shove.
Ow! Would you stop?
Would you move?
Well, maybe I would if please was somewhere in your limited vocabulary.
Oh, here we go. Well, please, why don't you say what you really think?
What are you talking about?
That you think I'm an idiot?
Well, that's true of everyone compared to me.
Knock it off, both of you, Ryan said, headache brewing.
Sorry, Cap.
Nico read his screen as Lessa moved past him in a huff.
Check this out. That serial number I ran through, it's coming up as a part on the UNSC Rubicon science vessel. Once we return to civilization, we can run the name through Waypoint and see what comes up.
Good idea.
Ryan moved along the other bulkhead wall, inspecting the haphazard bits of wreckage, until Les's shriek split through her earpiece. She swung around, rifle at the ready as Les stumbled back, bumping into a utility counter behind her, her weapon hastily drawn and pointed at a figure on the ground. Heart in her throat, Ryan approached slowly. Seeing that there was no danger, she placed a hand on Les's gun, lowering the weapon, then crossed to the figure on the ground.
Ram, you seeing this? She asked.
Jesus. Yeah, I'm seeing it. Don't know what it is, but I'm seeing it.
Nico edged his way in front of Ryan and knelt to get a better look.
Holy hell! Would you look at this?
Ryan nudged the figure's metal foot. The thing was a loose collection of humanoid metal parts. Legs, feet, torso, arms, hands, head. Made of some type of black metal alloy, it was weathered and damaged in places, and unlike anything she'd seen before. The pieces had an elegant and sleek design to them, but there was nothing else around that showed how those pieces fit together. She had to agree with Nico. It was fascinating, though the head was a little disconcerting with its angles and lines, which seemed to carve out a somewhat sinister-looking humanoid face.
Could it be experimental? Nico asked. How much you think something like this is worth?
He shined his light over the thing.
It looks human, yet more advanced than anything I've ever seen. Maybe this is like some next-gen Spartan android or something, like a prototype?
He swung his head around and met Ryan's gaze.
This could be the asset, what Oni is after.
Lessa remained quiet through Nico's assessment, but when he paused, she asked,
You don't think this is the thing that made all this? The antenna, the grave? Do you?
They stared at it, wondering. Lessa might be right. From what Ryan had seen so far, the Rubicon had entered the atmosphere and crashed at a very high rate of speed. That a human could survive that, and then survive here for years with no air, no food. Nico turned over the torso to check out the back.
I don't see a power source or anything that connects the pieces.
The cloth flapped outside. Sand pinged the fuselage like gentle rain, and the wind rocked sections of the hull. And still it felt too quiet.
Put it in the cart, Ryan told Nico. And then dismantle the antenna. While you do that, we'll keep looking around.
A few hours later, they'd explored the main wreck and the surrounding dunes. They were sweaty and tired, and made slow work of pushing the grav carts over the sand to the ship. Ryan said a grateful prayer to Lady Luck. If not for the weak gravity, this day would have been rough. When they reached the ship, she waited until Nico and Lessa were inside with their gear, then hit the airlock. Once through, they proceeded into the cargo hold where Ram was waiting. He'd also brought cold drinks.
You're a saint. Thanks.
Ryan removed her mask and drank deep before issuing everyone's favorite order.
All right, kids. Let's get this hull unloaded.
Chapter 17.
They are fascinating, these humans. Much different than the crew of the Rubicon with their military protocols and professional distance. There is very little protocol here, and very little distance. They are driven by emotion, their actions dictated by their feelings for one another. This is strangely unsettling. The bickering between the younger two, relatives to be sure, obvious by their accents, features, and mannerisms, is hypnotic. The older female is their captain, but I perceive she is much more than that. The crew views her as a mother figure, a protector, and a friend. I absorb every word, every move, and as I am transported into the hold of their ship, I realize that they are, much to my surprise, thieves, salvagers, opportunists. This is altogether unexpected. I find myself excited. A sudden rush of warmth fills me. Thievery and opportunity are old friends indeed, and I recognize them with much fondness. As they argue and laugh and talk, I am reminded quite clearly, perhaps more clearly than ever before, of my past, my human life, my relationships and friends. I see memories. The brim of a palm leaf hat hanging over my eyes as my calloused feet walk on soft sand. I see bronze, work-worn hands, dirt beneath the nails as I push through jungle. Bright white flashes of sunshine through green, chuffing laughter ahead of me, complaints behind me, and the joy of hunting and scheming and thieving. I am jarred suddenly from this memory as my parts are placed in a large metal storage bin. There are several of these along the walls of the cargo hold. Once this is achieved, the captain says they will continue looking around the wreckage for a data core. They won't find one. They leave, and soon the hold grows quiet. I power my visual components and examine my surroundings. Nearby, on a bulkhead wall, is a systems panel. I engage my hard light, assemble, and climb out of the bin to access the ship systems. Without one of the humans' AIs on board, everything is open to me without resistance. Information floods in. Details about humanity and the current time period flow in at a rapid rate. The data is full and robust and varied. I see we have a common hindrance in the Office of Naval Intelligence. The office, ONI, as it is called, has left a few surveillance filaments threaded into the ship's fiber optics and communications cables. These I untangle and gladly destroy. I see that a navigational and communication-wide cleanse was recently implemented. This, however, does not hinder my ability to delve into the personal files and messages and other detritus of the crew's lives, even using the displays in their quarters as viewports to observe their personal spaces. I run free through filaments brimming with code, with life and pictures and history. Lucy Orion Forge, Ramsey Shalva, Lessa and Nico, siblings and orphans without a surname. The captain's past gives me pause as a name I find, Spirit of Fire,
rings like an echo through the damaged halls of my memory. It is a ghost, a vague and sudden skip, and then it is gone, too quick to capture. I move on, certain that the knowledge is there and will reveal itself in time. And when it does, I will coax it into place, letting it settle where it was meant to. Once I glean every fragment of data there is, I turn my attention to the complete and utter lack of ship systems. It is extraordinary that these humans have made it through space with such rudimentary functions. Awareness of all the things that can and will go wrong because of such simplicity creates a surprising sense of protectiveness in me. They are vulnerable without an ancilla, without advanced shields and weapons and drives. For expedience's sake, I simply must repair these issues. This is not out of line with my original objective with the Rubicon. My ship must have the capability to travel over great distances, quickly and accurately. Therefore, upgrades must be implemented. And I certainly do not want to lose another crew. There are enough cryopods on the ship to suspend them while I resume my work. However, this may not be the best option. The last time such a thing was attempted, the result was not exemplary. I find I am hesitant. I will ponder my choices carefully. While the pull is strong to begin administering aid to the ship systems, I retreat to my storage cart. They are returning.
Chapter 18. Back from their second canvas of the wreck site, Nico began unloading the carts as Ryan headed out for one last attempt at finding a data core. Lesso went up to the lounge to make a quick meal for everyone, while Ram remained on the bridge, monitoring Ryan's movements. Besides the humanoid metal thing, they hadn't found much of note. Normally, sorting salvage into bins wasn't Nico's favorite job, but in this case, he would have volunteered. He couldn't seem to stop arguing with Lessa, and he continued to say the rudest things to his sister. Annoyed and on edge, he turned the volume up on his music until the cargo hold vibrated and began sorting the tangle of cables and metal from the grav carts, tossing pieces into the appropriate bins. It took nearly an hour to work through the mess. After a quick drink, he decided a break from cables was in order and went for the bin with the humanoid thing. The metal pieces were surprisingly light, the alloy worn and pitted by the sand, perhaps by the crash. Nico placed each piece on the floor to roughly make its intended shape. Head, torso, arms, legs, hands, feet. He stood back and stared down, scratching his jaw. There was nothing to connect the pieces. No cables, wires, or internal structures that he could see. So how did this thing fit together? He continued staring at it for a while, then decided to rummage through the cart of smaller salvage they'd taken from the work table. He heaped small optics, busted circuit panels, and more cables onto his workstation. A few pieces caught his interest, but there was nothing that looked like it might belong to their resident robotic construct. A scrape of metal sounded above the loud music. Nico stilled. That was odd. Another soft clang echoed behind him. A slow shiver started down his spine, and the hairs on his arms lifted. Pulse leaping, he casually reached over and turned his music down, feeling completely freaked out because he could swear someone was standing behind him. But that would be silly, right? The airlock was engaged. No one should be back here. He took in a few steadying breaths and hoped to hell that he was just imagining things. In seconds, there was another soft scrape, followed by smooth whirring sound. Oh God, there was something behind him. Hands shaking, he scanned the table and grabbed a metal bar from the salvage, swallowed, said a prayer, and slowly turned around. Oh shit, the thing was up. The robot was up. Adrenaline raced beneath his skin, lighting electric chills through his nerves. Nico stepped back, hitting the table and dropping the metal bar. It clanged loudly, echoing in the silence. Blue light glowed in between the dull, weathered plates and up through its head, carving out sharp, sinister cheekbones,
a mouth and large slanted blue eyes. It had to be nearly 3 meters tall and was held together by nothing, just magnetism, maybe? Nico's thoughts were racing. It seemed to be staring at him. His heart hammered hard in his chest, and his throat had gone bone dry. That's what lack of sleep did to you. Messed with your mind, screwed reality right the hell up. He rubbed his eyes, blinked hard a few times, but the thing was still there, still staring.
Guess I don't need to look for those missing parts.
The thought caused a nervous laugh to spurt from his mouth. The thing tilted its head in response, and Nico almost fainted. It felt like hours before he found his voice, managing a few intelligent words.
Holy shit!
He swallowed again, uncertain whether the thing was sentient or not, but it sure seemed to be studying him.
Okay, let's try this again. Hey?
Its head tilted again, and then it repeated.
Hey. Oh, dear God.
Nico had never fainted in his life, but he was pretty sure this was how it felt, all the blood just collapsing out of your body, the whole universe tilting. Despite his fear, another nervous laugh popped out of his mouth. He dragged his fingers nervously through his hair, a thread of excitement finding its way past his panic.
Okay, he said to himself.
Yeah, so... He could barely hear himself speak through the pounding of his heart. He searched for something to say as he hit his comm pad.
Well, you're taller than I thought you'd be.
No response.
Right. Okay. I'm Nico. You're on a ship, the Ace of Spades. We rescued you. From out there. The surface of that place. That planet.
It dipped its head.
My thanks, Nico.
Nico scrubbed a hand down his face and let out a shaky breath. He wasn't sure whether to just give in and collapse in shock or clap his hands in demented glee. He was caught somewhere between fear and amazement. He'd never seen anything like it, and it was definitely sentient, its voice an octave higher than his, with a strange resonance and a little scratchy. Then it moved, and Nico was pretty sure he might actually die. It leaned toward him. Nico leaned back, his hands gripping the work table behind to steady himself. But the thing reached past him into the salvage bin next to the table, from which it retrieved a long metal piece. It straightened and set the end of the piece on the ground, holding it like a cane to support the damage on one of its metal calves.
What are you?
Nico released his death grip on the table. It cocked its head again, then seemed to look down at its collection of metal and blue light.
I am.
It paused, as if it either had forgotten what it was or simply couldn't decide.
Hey, it's okay. Maybe something easier. What's that light? Is it what's holding you together? The Forerunners refer to it as hard light.
It straightened and turned its head slightly as though listening.
Your friends are coming.
The metallic clang of footsteps sounded above him, but all Nico could process was the word Forerunner.
It said Forerunner.
He glanced over his shoulder to see Lessa hurrying down the stairs and stopping halfway at the sight. Her face was pale and horrified as she lifted the barrel of the assault rifle over the railing.
Whoa, whoa, whoa!
Nico shouted, leaping in front of the construct. Above them, Ram was on the catwalk with his own heavy assault rifle.
Don't you dare shoot! He yelled. Please!
For a moment, no one seemed sure what to do next. Then the thing spoke again.
Hello, Lessa.
It dipped its chin to acknowledge her before looking up to the catwalk.
Ram Shalva. It knows our names, Nico said in awe.
He turned around and faced it again with an odd mix of horror and delight.
Nico, what did you do? Lessa snapped. Nothing, I swear. He is correct, the construct said, surprising him. Nico, move away.
Ryan was standing inside, the airlock door closed behind her, her helmet falling to the floor, her rifle aimed, her breathing rapid. She must have heard the comm as well, and hightailed it back to the ship. The deadly glint in her eyes as she sighted down the barrel of her weapon magnified Nico's fear exponentially. Time slowed, and he couldn't seem to find his voice. But then he didn't have to.
"Captain Forge," the thing said from behind him. "I have awaited rescue from this planet for quite some time. You have my thanks."
The crew exchanged bewildered glances, all concerned and unsure how to proceed.
"You're welcome," Ryan replied slowly.
"Guys," Nico managed finally. "I think it's Forerunner. It's a Forerunner robot."
Nico turned around as the thing let out an odd, strangled sound.
"Goodness, I am not a robot."
It stood straighter.
"This form is a sniper-class combat armiger. I have adopted this construct out of necessity. It is not my original form, nor my previous form." "Then what was?"
Ram asked, eyes narrow with suspicion from the catwalk above. It paused.
"Maybe he doesn't know what he is," Nico offered.
"Or maybe this is what Oni was creating on that wrecked ship," Lessa said. "This could be what they're now looking for." The armiger seemed to bristle at that.
"The Office of Naval Intelligence does not have the technology capable of creating me, child."
Nico's eyes went wide, and he saw that Ryan's did as well. They weren't sure what to make of that, but he felt like bursting. The thing obviously possessed emotion, and his all-time favorite, sarcasm. He wanted to laugh out loud, but bit his tongue instead.
"I did not want to frighten you out there on the surface. I have been delayed. My ship and my humans gone. Therefore, I require..."
"The Rubicon was your ship?" Ryan stepped forward, motioning with her rifle for Nico to move away. He edged to the side, creating an option to run if necessary, but not so far away to prevent him from protecting the armiger once again if need be.
"No, I simply had need of it."
"So you hijacked it?"
"In a manner of speaking."
The cap's mouth went tight. When she looked like that, shit was about to get serious. Nico prayed that things weren't about to take a nosedive. "Yes or no," she said. "It's a simple question."
"Then yes, if you insist on defining my actions in such a manner."
"And the crew? Did you kill them?"
"Of course not."
It was said with enough surprise and indignation that Nico believed him.
"They were human. I needed them."
"So you kidnapped them?"
"Also true, in a manner of speaking. I find your mode of questioning quite annoying."
"Why did you kidnap them?" Silence. "Okay, let me get this straight. You stole an Oni vessel and kidnapped its crew, and then crashed the ship. Everyone died except you. Does that about sum it up?"
"That is correct. But the crash and their deaths were not my intention. I strove to protect them. As I said, I needed them. Soon after I took control, there were complications. By my calculations, I am only 62.35% culpable in the tragedy."
"How did you survive the crash?" Nico interrupted.
"It was a simple matter of moving from one data stream to another, readjusting as things burned and broke. There was salvage in one of the science bays. These parts recovered from the R, from the same place I was recovered."
"Jesus, it's only 62.35% culpable."
Ram sat down on the catwalk, legs hanging over and rifle resting across his legs.
"I am not an it, Ram Shalva. I am human, like you, only far superior, and I do not appreciate your impertinence."
Nico clutched his heart and spun around to face the crew.
"It doesn't appreciate his impertinence," he repeated, barely able to contain his excitement.
Then he swung back around.
"Wait, what do you mean? You're human?"
Chapter 19.
They stare at me as though I am mad or in jest, which I find highly irritating. I certainly am not jesting. Madness, however, the emotion stirring inside of me, indignation, annoyance, impatience, flow freely, all things remembered, all things simulated, though they manifest as very real. How odd. I suppose from their point of view, the idea of me being human is inconceivable. But then, their vision of what is possible is small and limited. No matter, I will expand their minds. This notion gives me tremendous pleasure. I am human, I want to say again. I am Chaikas. I am 343 Guilty Spark. I am Forerunner. And Scylla, Armiger. Am I? Or was I? Perhaps that is where my conflict lies. I stand perfectly still. Many of my fragmented personality strings were repaired and combined or jettisoned in my time on the planet. Two remain. Fire and ice, they clash. They do not belong together. Yet I oversee them both, am inspired by both, nurtured by both, and guided by both. Have I become a third string, then? The overseer of the other two? A millisecond passed as I pondered this. The crew moves closer together. They whisper, casting wary glances my way. I, of course, can hear every word. Their suspicion and separation do not improve my disposition. I am here. They are there. I am not like them. I will never be like them. Of course, I have no desire to be. Perhaps it is the weapons aimed in my direction, the fear my presence produces. It all feels oddly tiresome and familiar. I realize that the Armiger form is somewhat distressing. During my time on Gyranos A, I managed to make only minor changes to the severity of this form, due to a damaged interface between the construct's machine cells and the intelligence framework I commandeered. A ship has emerged from slipspace, I tell them. At its heading and speed, it will detect your ship in approximately 12 minutes.
How do you know that? Nico asks.
I have been in your ship's systems since boarding.
Oh, God, not again.
Captain Forge hurries to the systems panel nearby. I suggest you leave the planet immediately. You do not have the firepower capable of winning an engagement with an Oni prowler.
It's got to be the Turokado, Lessa says.
Ram jumps to his feet.
Already?
Delay any further and you will not have the capability to flee, Captain, I tell her. If they succeed in apprehending me, I will not be responsible for my actions. I have been imprisoned long enough, far longer than you can fathom. I mean you no harm. I will try very hard to be 0% culpable in any foreseeable damage to you or your ship. Now, please, you must flee.
Cap,
Nico says at the systems panel on the bulkhead wall.
He's right. There's a ship coming in fast. I know, I can see.
Captain Forge engages the ramp, then takes the stairs two at a time, but the ship wobbles. I have employed the Ace of Spades thrusters without her input. She grabs a railing to maintain her balance as the ship rises quickly through the thin air. Her eyes blaze at me.
Get out of my ship!
Apologies, Captain. I will not. Your decision process moves with all the impetus of a snail. You wasted time. Without my aid, we will be apprehended, and I simply cannot allow another delay. I lift my chin and fold my arms over my chest in a decidedly human gesture. They must know I mean what I say and will not be swayed. Nico watches the exchange with surprise and dread as the captain's cheeks turn red with anger. She wants control. I understand this. But, like me, she cares about her freedom and that of her crew. I am counting on it. She gives me one final scowl for good measure, knowing she is caught, knowing there is nothing she can do.
Do not fry my engine.
Acknowledged, Captain Forge. Please hold on and prepare to enter slipspace. We have not reached the exosphere of this planet, but I simply cannot wait. I enter coordinates and command the primitive drive to engage in a slipspace entry.
What are you doing? We can't jump here.
Captain Forge and the crew hold on as the ship surges upward. Of course we can, I say. The atmosphere is thin and composed mostly of carbons, which will enable us to open a portal in the stratosphere without incident. While it is a crude little ship, it answers my demands nimble and quick. Then suddenly, the quiet. As soon as we are in slipspace, Captain Forge runs up the remainder of the stairs to the panel at the landing.
Did they follow?
Lessa asks, still clutching the stair railing. No. The captain grabs the upper railing, her knuckles white and her mouth in an angry line.
Where the hell are you taking us?
I have plotted a course for the closest Forerunner facility, Etrin Harbridge. It contains everything I require for my journey ahead. I have been unable to connect with the Ancilla there, however, but it is no matter for concern. The crew seems bewildered by my reply, shock and disbelief the prevailing mood. Nico's dark eyes are very round. I watch him, trying to determine if the look on his face displays horror or excitement. I decide it is both. Whether the captain likes it or not, we are going to Etrin Harbridge. My itinerary has not changed. After utilizing one of the Ark's surviving portals to return to the galaxy, I intended to take the Rubicon there and apply an upgrade seed to the ship to prepare for the journey ahead, but the Ace of Spades will do just as well. In fact, it will do better. It is inconspicuous, smaller, faster, and much easier to manipulate. A Forerunner ship would be ideal, of course, but that would draw too much attention for my plans. As I study them, I detect another expression, closer to fear. It is the realization that they are trapped, like the birds I once caught as a boy and sold to a dealer in the streets of Marontic. So many cages, caught by something more intelligent and advanced. They are at my mercy, and they know it. I do not prefer this look on them. It, too, is familiar. I know what it is like to be controlled by others, to have my choices taken from me. If I do the same to these humans, does that not make me the same as the Didact, the Master Builder, and even the Librarian? Despite knowing they do not have a choice, they aim their meager weapons in my direction. They must know that firing them while in slipspace might result in total destruction, but I can see they will do what it takes to be free. Freedom means to them what it now means to me. I will not be imprisoned, I say.
Neither will we,
Captain Forge immediately replies. I have had 3 years on Gyranos A to repair, to parse and catalog and remember being human. I have not lost my past, have not lost what it feels like or what it is to be human. And I have not lost what it was to be 343 Guilty Spark. I remember, and I do not like what is remembered. Hard, pitiless, robotic, alone. I do not want to be that cold again. And I do not want to lose these humans the way I lost the others. I will not and cannot be imprisoned, I repeat, but neither will I imprison you. I realize this statement is placating and perhaps not entirely true. However, I must find a way to make them want what I want.
Chapter 20. Ace of Spades, Slipspace to Etrin Harbridge. Ace might have been moving peacefully through slipspace, but the battle inside Ryan was raging. Losing control of her ship was a goddamn nightmare. Tension filled the hold. Her weapon remained trained on the sleek metal components that formed the armature as it stared up at her through glowing blue eyes. So it didn't want anyone to be imprisoned, a hollow claim given that it had just infiltrated her ship's systems and issued commands. Still, Ryan was curious at its behavior. Whatever moral dilemma was taking place inside the armature might work in their favor, or it could become an utter disaster.
"You want us to believe you won't take over our ship the way you did the Rubicon," she said, lowering her weapon and moving down the stairs.
"I admit that was my original intention. But I see now that if I am to truly embrace my humanity, I shall employ a different tactic."
It gave a slight bow, as though bestowing a great honor upon them.
"Cooperation."
Ryan paused.
"Cooperation," she repeated, unimpressed.
"Indeed. Etrin Harbridge is a forerunner S.H.I.E.L.D. world captain. Taking you there benefits us both. Within this world, you can claim all the materials and tools your ship can carry. There is an entire Forerunner fleet at your disposal. And you are in desperate need of salvage, are you not?"
It was cunning. She'd give it that.
"Hold on, though. You still haven't answered my original question," Nico said. "And just now, what did you mean by embrace your humanity? Were you really human? Did the Forerunners make you, and how is that even possible? Forerunners and humans didn't exist in the same timeline, not even close."
"The history of the human race has been lost through war, through time, through the machinations of those long gone, and those at the highest levels of your current society. I assure you, humanity did indeed exist during the time of the Forerunners. Humans were a force in the galaxy, an interstellar civilization with advances even the Forerunners did not fully understand."
Ryan paused on the stairs, completely baffled by its words.
"So then, where are they now?"
"Long gone, I'm afraid. Humanity engaged in a brutal war with the Forerunners, and they lost. As punishment, they were devolved back to mere hunter-gatherers and returned to their homeworld, Erde Tyrene, what you call Earth. I was born among these devolved humans. I was human. Then I was Forerunner. I bore witness to the end of it all, and I survived for 100,000 years, waiting and watching the galaxy come back to life after we ended it."
"You're 100,000 years old, Les said, caught between astonishment and suspicion.
It nodded.
"Give or take, yes."
Its words rang in Ryan's head. Everything it said went against the entire foundation of human history, everything they knew, everything that was. It spoke with such matter-of-fact simplicity that it gave her a moment's pause, and she didn't know how to respond or feel, and neither, obviously, did the crew. Remnants of Forerunner's ancient and mysterious civilization littered the galaxy, adding pieces to a past that had long been forgotten. If they existed 100,000 years ago, what else was possible? Ryan powered down her rifle, slung it behind her hip, and climbed the stairs once more. She headed across the catwalk, growing annoyed and angry, alarm bells ringing in her head, tiny strands of doubt twisting and threading through her instincts and beliefs.
"Where are you going?" Nico called after her.
She threw up a hand and kept walking. Who the hell knew? She was just going. She'd heard enough. This wasn't the plan. They should be out there salvaging, looking for her father, doing what they did, getting on with the lives they had built, not involved in some weird-ass Oni experiment with a crazy robot who thought he was an eons-old human. This wasn't what she wanted. After a brief moment of hesitation, the crew followed, leaving the armature behind, filing into the lounge behind Ryan. She immediately went for the marsh cane whiskey in the cabinet above the sink, grabbed a glass and poured a healthy dose, downing its harsh bite in one gulp. Her eyes closed as she concentrated on the burn in her throat and the warmth spreading across her unsettled stomach. A hand grabbed the bottle from her grasp. She opened her eyes to see Ram taking her glass and pouring his own drink. When he was done, he passed it on to Lessa and then Nico. For a long, heavy moment, no one spoke. No one knew what to say.
"You think it's telling the truth?"
Ram finally asked as he leaned against the counter. Ryan let out a sharp laugh. "That it won't take over? Or that it's a 100,000-year-old human mind in a Forerunner-constructed body? Or the humans were once contemporaries with the Forerunners? Or that they regressed us back to cavemen?" She rolled her eyes. "Jesus, take your pick." "I don't see a reason for him to lie about history," Nico said. He was sitting at the table, chair kicked back. "And if he wanted to take over, he could have done so."
"It already has," Lessa said, dropping onto the couch. "It's just being nice about it, for now."
"And who's to say that once we outlive our usefulness, it won't just kill us or take Ace and leave us stranded? We have no idea what its plans are or what its end goal is," Ryan said. All they knew was that they were on a course for some Forerunner shield world. Nico sat forward, shaking his head. "You guys aren't really seeing the big picture here. Let's say he's telling the truth. He might have been formed from a working human mind, but he's now a completely functioning Forerunner AI. Do you not see the value in that?"
"Sure, if we could trust it," Lessa said blandly.
"He has 100,000 years of knowledge," Nico persisted. "He probably knows where every Forerunner planet and city and hub was, how to operate relics and artifacts, how to build Forerunner technology. Hell, he's taking us to a Forerunner world where we can pick and choose our salvage. This is everything we ever dreamed about."
"And here I was thinking we'd just be lifting a data core," Ryan muttered, downing another shot of whiskey. She wiped a hand over her mouth. "We are going to have the entire UEG after this thing."
"Not necessarily," Ram said. "You heard it. It said it wasn't in the Armiger body when the Rubicon crashed. If it's to be believed, no one knows it's this thing now. For all Oni knows, the AI was destroyed when the ship crashed. They might have no idea if it survived or who placed the distress call."
"No, but the Torokado might have identified us as we were leaving," Lessa said. "Either way, they'll go down to the site and they'll see a lot of salvages missing. And if they know it's us, they'll have to come after Ace to make sure we don't have their asset. It doesn't change the fact that now we're a target."
"It's a big galaxy, Les. We might end up a target, but now we have a super AI on our side," Nico said.
"It's on its own side, Nico, not ours," Les fired back. "It has its own agenda."
Silence settled in the lounge, the low drone of Ace's engines humming in the background. Ryan stared out the viewscreen, nothing but black and the occasional streak of some star beyond the bubble of slipspace. A cage was still a cage, no matter how free they were to roam around within it. The Armiger had access to every part of her ship, and very likely was listening in even now. And while they were stuck in slipspace, there wasn't a damn thing she could do about it. "We're on hold until we're out of the jump," she told them. "Nico, make sure you finish maintenance on Michelle. We might need her where we're going." He frowned.
"But..."
Ryan gave him a pointed look. Michelle didn't need maintenance, but she had a very nice EMP pulse generator. They couldn't use it anywhere near the ship, but once they got to wherever the Armiger was taking them, Ryan needed all options available, especially the ability to shut that thing down and regain control. Chapter 21. Facility at Voi, Kenya, Africa, Earth. Annabelle sat back in her desk chair and rubbed her face in frustration, trying very hard to maintain her composure. A salvage ship. A goddamn salvage ship. Unbelievable. And they jumped before the Torokado could stop them. They could be clear across the galaxy by now. She wanted to scream. Outer colony opportunists were dregs, thorns in the UEG's side. Oni had better things to do than play babysitter to a bunch of low-life thieves and smugglers. There were bigger things going on in the galaxy, much bigger things. And to make matters worse, Hugo Barton was on the line lecturing her about the importance of his research and...
"And if you ever pull my team and my ship off course again, I will make a formal complaint to Cinconi and HICOM."
She let out a long, steady breath.
Obtaining 343 Guilty Spark is a far higher priority than a Forerunner debris field at the moment. I realize the Torquato is under your command, but it was the closest ship to my asset. If you want to take it up with Osman, please go right ahead. And while you're on that, ask yourself who approved transfer of command.